Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. Sign up at decodingtv.com to become a paid member, get ad-free episodes and early access to episodes, and help to keep this podcast running. Thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com who makes this podcast possible.
You were abducted.
Stop saying that. I had a bad day. I needed some time to clear my head. Did I leave the house a mess? Well, shoot. I know you think I'm this kind of perfect woman, wife, mother. But you know, even I got a breaking point.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Streaming, a Decoding TV podcast. I'm David Chen, and I will have some of that cake, thank you. Joining me today, you've seen her work on her YouTube channel where she goes by Jessie Gender. Jessie Earle, welcome back to Decoding TV.
Oh, gosh there, David. It's so good to be here. I'm just hanging out and in my hot tub talking about traditionalist gender values, don't you know?
Nicely done. Well, each week, This Week in Streaming, we cover a show that's new and interesting in the world of streaming. We tell you if it's worth watching, and if it is, we'll review and spoil and discuss the entire season of the show. This week, we are covering Fargo Season 5, Episodes 1 through 5. Those episodes entitled The Tragedy of the Commons, Trials and Tribulations, The Paradox of Intermediate Transactions, Insolubilia, and The Tiger. Now, Jessie Earle, this is a little bit of a late addition to the This Week in Streaming catalog. I think I had not been watching the show as it was airing, but I had talked with you about what you're watching, and you had said, "Oh, I'm loving Fargo season 5." So I watched all 5 episodes of the season in one day.
Oh gosh!
And I was so compelled by it. I said, "Hey, let's cover the show if you're up for it." Of course, Jessie graciously agreed. So I'm so excited to talk about it with you. We're going to talk about overall thoughts, right? And then we're going to move into a fairly detailed spoilery recap. You can find more episodes of the show at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com and find us across all platforms, especially on YouTube, where you may be watching this at youtube.com/@decodingtv. All right, Jessie Earle, let's talk about Fargo Season 5. Overall thoughts, then we'll get into spoilery detailed recap. And I guess, you know, even before we get to Fargo season 5, let's talk about our relationship to the movie and also to the series. You go first, Jessie. What are your thoughts on the film? What are your thoughts on the series? You know, have you been keeping up all these years?
Oh, yeah. I've been watching every season as it's come out, and I've been a huge fan of the show since its very first season. Like, every season has been, other than last season, season 4 was, I think, probably its weakest, and I think that's generally the sentiment for most people. This series, I think, has been really strong. It's always centered, like, really interesting and, like, unique performances. I think probably the most unique was season 3, where they had Ian McGregor doing, like, a dual performance against himself, playing two different characters, which was kind of fun. I think the show has always been really clever, always takes, like, weird, wild swings, yet still somewhat feels very Fargo. And I'm also a big fan of Noah Hawley, because he also wrote Legion, which is one of my favorite superhero shows of all time. I appreciate the show's just constantly swinging for the fences and taking weird choices, especially with such a unique property with Fargo, like it being sort of a murder mystery sort of Minnesotan story. So yeah, I've been loving this series, other than season 4, which I thought was a bit of a dip, but again, it's, you know, it's every series has one, I assume. So
I watched season 1, I thought it was okay. I watched season 2 and thought it was great. And then I kind of just fell off. You know, there's a pretty significant amount of time between seasons. And so I kind of fell off the Fargo train and then never got back on. But my co-host on the film cast, Jeff Cannata, had said season 5 was excellent. And so you said it was excellent. And so I thought to myself, I got to check this out. So let's talk about our overall thoughts on these first 5 episodes. I mean, the season premiere of season 5
mm-hmm.
opens the season so strongly that it's one of those episodes where I watched it and I thought, okay, it doesn't matter how bad the rest of the season is.
It was worth
this moment.
That was
so good that it's going to propel me to the end of the season. I can coast off the fumes of that through the end of the season. Because not only is it an exceptionally well-made piece of genre entertainment, that hour alone,
mm-hmm.
but it also is like a really fun reimagining of one of the scenarios from the movie Fargo, right?
Yeah.
So what were your thoughts on this season?
No,
so
it's the same exact thing. And I think the season generally, and it's kind of gone in its own places as the season's gone along, but it certainly has, even much more than perhaps maybe other than season one, than the rest of the other seasons drawn directly from the original movie. And I think that that's somewhat a response to season four, considering season four was just this really different take because it was set in Kansas City, was dealing with sort of like the different gangs that were sort of around there. And I believe what was it, the 1980s or something like that? I forget exactly when it was set, but it was just a very different take that didn't really work for everybody. So this feels like a very back to basics sort of show, season for the show. And I really like that it sort of started from that base of just going back to what the film was doing and then kind of going on its own thing, but then also really bringing in a lot of things to say about today, like a lot of the politics of sort of like rural and like Midwestern America, in sort of like Trumpian style politics and like things like that, and setting the series like just before COVID-19, like they make very explicit it's 2019 repeatedly in the show, was just interesting. So yeah, I think that this series is like,
any thoughts on why they said it in 2019, just so they don't need to deal with COVID
That's really the thing. It's like close enough that they can still have a lot of the political commentary that they want to have, while also not being like, well, we have to wear masks and COVID. Yeah, I think it was just a COVID thing.
Yeah, perhaps. And also perhaps when, you know, certain MAGA types might have felt like at the height of their power, at least one of the heights of their power. We'll see what happens in a couple
we'll
years.
See what happens. Well.
So anyway, yeah, I really liked the first 5 episodes of the season. We'll be covering the whole season, you know, in 5 or so weeks from now here on This Week in Streaming. But just wanted people to know kind of like, wanted to let people know where we are with this show. And that is that, as you said, Jesse, the first 5 episodes were pretty strong. There are some fantastical stuff out there that is like, I'm not sure where it's going, and it might go nowhere interesting, or it might be a little bit too random to really fit in with the show.
It's strong choices that needs to be said.
Decisions have been made. Yeah. Decisions have been made. I mean, I think, everything that has to do with the central character this season, who is played by Juno Temple, I think is excellent. Whenever Juno Temple is not on screen, I'm like, when are we going to get back to the Juno Temple character?
Yeah.
Right? And the other stuff, John Hamm, I also really like. And the other stuff is a little bit weaker. For instance, there is a very wealthy character played by, I believe, Jennifer Jason Leigh, right?
Yep, I believe so.
Plays Lorraine. And It feels extremely repetitive with, if you've seen Mike Flanagan's The Fall of the House of Usher this year.
Yes, yeah.
Like, not only the character and the mannerisms, but, like, literally both, you know, the House of Usher and Lorraine have dodgy lawyers who, like, go and do all their bidding for
them.
I
was thinking that exactly, too.
Most of their action takes place in this room that has floor-to-ceiling, like, in this corporate office that has floor-to-ceiling windows, so like visually it looks very similar. I just think it's unfortunate that both of these shows came out at about the same time.
And actually the show was supposed to come first. It got delayed because of the strike. It's kind of
but it feels like, I feel like I've seen this, and also I didn't really love it the first time I saw it, so like this time around I'm not loving that stuff either. That's probably one of the weaker aspects of the show for me, but anyway, overall, super strong first half of the season, and I think there is plenty to discuss. As you said, very socially relevant commentary as well. So it's not just trying to be fun genre fluff. It's trying to actually say something, and I think that's also admirable as well. So
yeah, and in ways that feel both on the nose and also subtle at the same time. In a weird way.
Yeah. So anyway, so much to dive into. But anyway, those are our overall thoughts on Fargo Season 5, Episodes 1 through 5.
Oh, gosh. Oh. It's so good. Sorry, I don't know where to go with that. I have to have an excuse. I roomed with one of my roommates in college was from Minnesota, so I just picked up the accent just for fun to make fun of them.
Wow. All right. Well, anyway, those are our overall thoughts on the first 5 episodes.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Let's get to the rest of the show and what actually happened this season. What we're going to do is, rather than do like episode by episode recap, Jesse has graciously broken it down by character. And so we'll take turns kind of discussing some of the main characters and then like go into what happens with each of the characters. So,
and it kind of goes in chronological order too, but yeah. So,
all right, I'll start. Jesse, we'll take turns. I'll start with Dot. Set in Scandia, Minnesota. Dot, who's played by Juno Temple, a housewife, finds herself in trouble when she inadvertently tasers an officer at her child Scotty's school board meeting. Arrested by a deputy, Indira Olmsted, Dot's troubles escalate as she is later kidnapped by criminals Munch and Ireland. After a daring escape, Dot conceals the events and returns home, leaving her doe-eyed husband Wayne puzzled, and Dot's mother-in-law Lorraine, a cutthroat businesswoman who owns a debt collection agency, intensely suspicious of Dot after learning of the events from an investigation by the local police. So That is largely the Dot storyline. The first episode of this show is so dazzling because, the home invasion happens very much like the home invasion scene happens in Fargo, the film. And so I've seen Fargo, the movie Fargo, probably, I don't know, 6 times. I already am intimately familiar with how that scene goes. And, you know, the framing is the same and the setup is the same. And it's this woman named Dot at home. But then things don't play out the same way as they do in the film.
Differently. Yeah.
And it is so delightful and surprising. And then, okay, Jesse, I was thinking to myself, all right, well, just the fact that she kind of got the jump on them in the house, that's already awesome. Like, that's already like, I've already been rewarded for like paying attention to Fargo. But then she manages to escape from them and have this standoff in this gas station, which is extremely well shot and executed. Like, just the lighting, the editing, the fact that Dot is really creative with how she is able to kind of take these guys down. The first episode is just one of my favorite hours of television this year. Yeah. What are your thoughts, Jesse?
No, I was just agreeing. I was just sitting back and just agreeing with you because, yeah, it is fantastic. I love that it sort of subverts a lot of the expectations based on the movie as well, because it's not just Dot, but also her husband, Wayne, as we'll get into a little bit more later on. But even from this first episode we can see, he's like actually a caring husband. And he has the same exact job as, why am I blanking on his name? The car salesman.
Jerry Lundegaard from Fargo.
Yes.
William H.
Macy's character. Says same exact job. And there's actually even a scene that's set in like his office that looks very similar as well in one of the later episodes. And it's very clearly evoking that. And yet he is actually a caring husband. He's not the one setting her up to be kidnapped or hiring people. So it is really fun how it, like, if you've seen the original movie, you can be rewarded. But it sort of plays with that in a really fun way. And also, I think, like, allows Dot to have a lot more agency as a character in this version than in the films, because, like, having a sort of damsel in distress sort of woman character probably wouldn't fly as much today. And so I really, really do, like, appreciate that. So, yeah. And also just, like, shout out to Juno Temple's performance. Like, I loved her in Ted Lasso. And she's not playing a character that's so far afield of that character in Ted Lasso. Mm-hmm. And yet there seems to be a lot of like really interesting depth and nuance that like just comes out at different moments throughout the season that I really love.
Yeah, I mean, there is a scene that she has with Lorraine later on where she drops the accent.
And just goes like, straight. It's like, you just,
you know,
let me.
Listen
yeah.
up, you bee. You know, like,
yeah, exactly.
And that's like amazing, where you realize like the whole thing is a put on that character mm-hmm. has.
But she likes it. She likes that performance too. Yeah. She enjoys being the like housewife that like it's just sort of that facade of like she's fiercer than she lets on. But she likes just being like, she just likes being the caring wife, you know? Which I thought
it's
was
a
really interesting.
You know, it's a common trope of former assassin desires to have the regular
life,
you know, everyday life. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of like other movies in which that's happened. I want to say like Salt is yeah. probably one of those movies where, you know, this character is like a housewife and, or not a housewife because she had a career in that movie, but mm-hmm. like. You know, she desires a normal domestic life with someone. Mm-hmm. And it's not just women either. Like, there's obviously many stories where, like, there's a male character that occupies that role. Mm-hmm. But sometimes all people want is to live the suburban life.
Yeah.
And it's very clear that this is what she wants. And she's literally willing to kill people
yeah.
to have it. Bad people. She's not mm-hmm. evil or anything. But she's willing to kill bad people to have it, which I think is really
and even kind of endanger herself and her family to a degree with it
yeah,
as well, because
yeah.
she makes some reckless choices as the season goes on where she's just like, I'm just going to complete, like, I'll prepare for it, but like I'm not going to run away or anything like that, which does put her husband and child in danger, which is interesting. It's like, you understand where she's coming from and why she makes the decisions she makes is like, where's she going to go? But also it is a sort of like, it's a difficult rock and a hard place choice.
Yeah. But the whole series hangs on this character in mm-hmm. order to work. This season, at least, hangs on this character in order to function. And I think she acquits herself very well.
Yeah.
And it's a very different performance than what I've seen her in. Like, the first movie I saw her in was this movie called Afternoon Delight. I don't know if you've seen that film.
No, I have not. Yeah.
It was in. It was released in 2013, and she plays this stripper that enters the life of this suburban housewife, and like kind of, you know, her very presence like reconfigures their whole dynamic and environment. And I think it's really interesting to see that she's kind of playing a version of the character that Catherine Hahn played in that movie Afternoon Delight that very few people have actually seen. So anyway, we can move on from that topic. But yeah. Yes, Dot, super interesting, super well done. Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention is I like how DIY a lot of Dot's, let's
traps
just say,
her.
Defensive techniques are, mm-hmm. right? Like, she doesn't seem like somebody who is ex-special forces, mm-hmm. but she does seem like somebody who is ex-survivalist, right?
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't have, like, I don't think she has, like, elite weapons training, but she knows how to use weapons. She knows how to, like, rig things up. The way she took down this guy in the bathroom using bags of ice was really interesting.
That
you know,
was
like,
great, yeah. And also, like, subverting people's expectations of what she's going to do as just, like, when she, like, hides in the closet and then comes rushing out at one point in the first
right.
episode, I believe, as well. So.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought her dynamic with the John Hamm's son character, or I guess I think it might be her son.
I don't think it's very clear. It's definitely yeah. it's definitely John Hamm's son. I don't know yeah. if it's officially confirmed.
He's had one wife before her, I think, is mm-hmm. what we understand. And so
she definitely has a relationship with Gator,
right? Right.
Which is John Hamm's son.
And there was a very interesting moment when like he and his buddies are storming their house, and he confronts her and is like, hey, come on, let's just, why are we doing this? Let's just go, you know, just get in the van and let's go. And, I, you know, it's just like kind of an interesting dynamic that it's rarely seen where, you expect kind of the trope of the damsel in distress, but it's like, it's not only not damsel in distress, it's somebody who kind of has a relationship with these people.
Yeah.
Who,
and she does kind of act like a mother too. She like shames him. It's like, what are you doing?
Right.
it was a very again, even if she's not like actually his biological mother, there's sort of like that like shame on you like sort of vibe to a kidnapping, which was very fun.
It almost feels like they like reverse engineered the plot. Like they're like, okay, what if that mm-hmm. scene from Fargo, but the woman was a complete badass. And it's like, okay, well, what are the circumstances under which that would even happen? And it's mm-hmm. like, she was married to this John Hamm character, and he taught her all these skills that she's now using against him, and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it all works, but it's just kind of
it's very clear how that was probably the pitch. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. All right. Anyway, that's stuff on Dot. We'll talk a little bit more about her as we continue. But tell us about Roy Tillman, Jesse Earl.
Well, Dot's kidnappers were hired by her ex-husband, Roy Tillman, played by John Hamm, a tyrannical and hyper-traditionalist sheriff in North Dakota, whom she escaped and started a new identity to avoid. Roy orders his son and deputy Gator to continually attempt to kidnap Dot to repeated failures. Roy also bumps up against the FBI, who are investigating Roy's unwillingness to enforce laws and his authoritarian behavior. Yeah.
So, what do you think of John Hamm? I think he's great this season. You know, he's mm-hmm. he's nailing this character, and you can totally see why that guy would be that way, like mm-hmm. in the way that he performs that character.
Yeah,
yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, no, he is very clearly meant to be a commentary. He's not meant to be like a one for one with Trump, but meant to be sort of an embodiment of that sort of hyper individualist, like traditionalist yeah. values sort of guy. Like, I think of the scene that we get introduced to him in, which was very fascinating, kind of comes back later on, where he's speaking to a husband and wife and sort of like admonishing the husband for mistreating his wife, but also sort of reinforcing these ideas with the wife of like, you need to care for him. Like, he is your husband. You've got to like be the good housewife. And sort of like enforcing these sort of like roles of like, this is what a man and woman are. Man is in charge, but he sort of like has to be this rugged individualist sort of guy. It's just this really interesting discussion of masculinity and sort of that individualist strongman sort of conservative politic.
Yeah, I would also argue heavy. I don't know if like Christian is the correct term for it, but it's clearly mm. very biblically inspired, I would argue.
Yes, yes.
That, you know, man's place is at the head of the home and the woman's place is to serve the man and mm-hmm. the man's place is to protect the woman. Like, it's a very I'm not saying. All Christians believe that, but there are certain sects,
like fundamentalist Christians.
Yeah,
sort of
sects
thing,
of
yeah.
Christianity, sects of Christianity that like use those scriptures to reinforce an ultra conservative worldview of how the family should be organized. And I think his, you know, not only is that his, you can imagine that's his relationship with his own family, but he tries to bring that out into the world as well. I watched this movie recently. I think it was on Amazon Prime, about the one of those families that had all the kids, you know?
Oh yeah, yes, yes.
The Quiverful movement documentary. Let me see. I just want to make sure. Was it Quiverful Inside the Patriarchy movement? Anyway, that's a book.
The woman's job is to repeatedly pump out as many babies as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was, it was like about John and Kate plus eight or something like that. You know, it was about one of those families that had like, tons of, kids. And it was, anyway, I apologize. I don't remember the exact name. I feel like I talked about it on the film cast at some point. But anyway, one of the points of that documentary was that that the teachings of Christianity or certain teachings of Christianity can be easily used and abused by those who wish to start cults, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it very much feels like that's kind of what he has done or how he sees himself, right, as this leader who mm-hmm. Not only can do what he wishes, but can kind of enforce his version of truth and justice upon everyone else. And this is no more like this is clearest when he straight up kills that abusive husband and then
yeah.
pins one of the murders on him. Right. Like mm-hmm. it is because he's like, oh, OK, I'm like people's lives are basically dispensable. Like I am judge, jury, and executioner. And not only can I kill people as I wish, but I'm going to reconfigure truth in such a way that is maximally beneficial to me and for my self-preservation. Yeah. And so I think that's a really kind of compelling and also demonstrably something that people have done in real life is they've used scriptures in order to kind of enforce this cult-like worldview on them and their followers and their family and their friends and so on and so forth. So that's also pretty interesting. I'm kind of curious where that's going to end up. Jesse Earle, any thoughts there?
Me as well. I mean, I'm also curious about too. There's a really good scene too where he's in the hot tub talking to the FBI agents, and they sort of also have this interesting discussion of like he's not enforcing the laws, and it's more about like how he's pressing his own sort of way of viewing the world through his authority that he is like he won through theoretically quote unquote democratic means, though of course it's sort of implied that he got that through coercion and intimidation. But it's just sort of interesting is sort of like the might makes right sort of argument that he sort of brings up there, which I found interesting. So yeah, I'm curious to see where they're gonna go with his story.
I love the dynamic between him and his son Gator. Like Gator, is such a jerk, and not particularly competent, right? No. And you kind of know who that character is right away. You're like, this guy is super hateable, arguably more hateable than Jon Hamm himself because he's so annoying.
Yeah, he reminds me of Cyril Karn from Star Wars Andor. Very similar vibes.
Very similar dynamics, except he's more. He has more weapons, right? He's more armed.
Yes.
But yeah, is it very similar? Like, wants to enforce this fascism onto the people, but doesn't really have the competence to do it. He kind of
and it's continually shamed by. Sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah, no worries. Well, the character reminds me a lot of the dynamic between Gator and his father reminds me of the dynamic between Jon Hamm's character and Pete Campbell, Don Draper and Pete Campbell in Mad Men. Like,
I've never seen Mad Men, which is a show. Okay.
Basically, there is like one guy who cannot live up to the masculine ideals of Jon Hamm in the show Mad Men. And so he always has this big chip on his shoulder and always is trying to like be a man and be impressive, and he's always failing at it, and it's kind of very sad. And that's kind of who the Gator character is. He is, you just know, like when he's assigned a new task, which happens multiple times in the first five episodes, he's going to fail horribly and be humiliated. And I'll be surprised if he survives to the end of the season. What do you think, Jesse Earle?
Yeah, it'll be interesting if he does too. I love that idea of also the shame that he feels and that sort of like reinforcement of his masculinity being continually emasculated, just being this like propellant force that caused him to do dumber and dumber and more violent and more harmful things. So I'm curious to see where that is going to eventually reach its peak, because I feel like there's going to be a moment where he's just going to be so emasculated by either Jon Hamm or Dot or somebody or a mixture of the two that it's going to come out in some form of violence. Knowing Fargo, it will be like a very violent rupture. I'm very curious what they're building towards with that. Because
he's
going to
snap, basically. Mm-hmm. And
exactly.
Terrible will happen,
yeah. And do something stupid and very terrible. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I love the dynamic between the two of them. Also, you can tell a lot, but just by their wardrobe, honestly, right? Like Jon Hamm's clothing is very loose fitting and it kind of matches. He's like largely very casual about the fact that he can do whatever he wants. Whereas Gator is kind of dressed up in these like military fatigues and, you know, really wants to like show everyone that he's the boss. Mm-hmm. But like the people who are really the boss, they don't feel like they need to demonstrate that to others. You know? I guess I have some thoughts on Munch, but we can talk about him momentarily because it's related to Gator and so on and so forth. Trying to think if there's anything else to say about this storyline.
We'll get a little bit more when it intersects, because I found how that storyline intersects with Lorraine in a little bit very interesting, but we can get to that.
That's fair. Okay. Let's talk about Munch. Munch, one of Dot's captors, proves to be a ruthless criminal with a penchant for violence who only refers to himself in the third person. After Munch asks for more money upon learning of Dot's resourcefulness, Roy attempts to have Munch killed, but Munch escapes and begins a vendetta against Roy's men. He also takes up residence in a random woman's house. In a flashback to 500 years in the past, we see Munch, or a past incarnation of Munch, being paid to take on a dead man's sins into his soul, painting the modern-day Munch as either an immortal cursed man or an unknown supernatural force.
Random swerve that story takes.
Right, so essentially, like, you're watching the show and the character of Munch is this really cool archetype of like Anton Chigurh-esque I'm going to kill everybody because they wronged me. I mean, Munch seems like a complete badass, but the only thing that doesn't make any sense to me is why he would think Roy would pay him after not having completed the job. That part didn't make any sense to me, but you know, everything else all adds up. And then, you know, he is going around executing Roy's men one by one and like doing threatening, scary things. And then all of a sudden he shows up in this old woman's house who he calls mama, but apparently is not related to him.
Yeah.
Just a random person,
by the way.
And then it flashes back 500 years into the past where a guy who looks like Munch, played by actor Sam Spruill, engages in the ritualistic practice of sin eating. Now, I didn't even really remember this, right? But in the olden days, there would be these people called sin eaters who would eat a cake or a piece of food that supposedly had the sins of a deceased person bestowed onto it, and that way the sin eater would be absorbing the badness and evil and sin. Advantage, it was a paid role, and you probably got to make a decent living from it. Disadvantage, if you were a sin eater, you would often be shunned by society. People would not want to associate with you for fear of the sin rubbing off on them. So it was a very lonely and terrible existence. So anyway, Jesse, what was your reaction when we flash back 500 years in the past? And then is that the same guy as the present day? Like what is happening? What do you think's going on?
I loved this. It was such a weird take to go, but it was so weird and yet felt very Fargo and also very Coen Brothers despite it. I mean, you mentioned Anton Chigurh, who like in that movie, he does sort of have that sort of supernatural force presence, even though it's never explicitly made that way. He does feels that way. So like this character feels very much in that same vein. And I really liked it because it just paints this interesting sort of like third entity sort of like encroaching on this storyline that he honestly hasn't had much to do directly in these past five episodes. I mean, he's had some influence. He's like shown up and killed some people and like made like things more up the stakes in a certain sense. But in terms of like his direct presence on the storyline, in terms of like his desires and actions pressing upon it, it's not really had that much influence. And so it just creates this like foreboding sense, especially when we got this flashback that like just some sort of force in the world is sort of ethereal and sort of revolves around these types of incidents that I found really, really fascinating as a choice. And also just sort of paints him as like this, again, the idea of like the sin eating and like taking upon sin. It's an interesting concept to sort of put into this because it's a lot of our characters are kind of playing with that idea, especially Dot, where she's like trying to excise, like we don't know if she did anything particularly bad in the past, but she's definitely trying to excise her past in some way. So it's an interesting sort of like additional thematic component that sort of like draws out the themes of what the characters are trying to play with. So I found that. And also too, you can even tie in the idea of Lorraine, you know, Lorraine as being this like overbearing, like cutthroat businesswoman. And presumably, like, the sin eaters would eat the sins of pretty terrible people or people who have done, like, who have money to be able to have their sins eaten. And so there's even that sort of, like, class discussion that you could even bring into with the character of Munch as well. So, I don't know. It's just, he's just this weird outside thing that I think is just, it adds some really fun vibes that I think thematically complements the show in really interesting ways.
Yeah, some of the stars and creators of Fargo have talked to TV Insider and given some insight on what is going on with this character. So I wanted to read some quotes here. Again, these are from TV Insider. Noah Hawley says, quote, "What I wanted to explore with Munch character, with the Munch character, really was this idea of debt and sin eating and this idea of what the rich make the poor do. And part of what the rich do to the poor is make them feel like it's their fault they're poor. And that if these poor people have to borrow money from us, it makes them less than. And then we impose this morality on them that they can't pay back," end quote.
With Lorraine, I didn't even read that because you added these after in our notes after we did this. I actually hadn't read this. But yeah, that even ties really nicely into Lorraine being a debt collector.
Sam Spruill, who plays the character of Munch, had this to say, quote, "This guy is not straightforward, and it took me a while to understand. And that when he started understanding the depth of his intention, I got it, Sam Spruill says. And I think the root of him really lay in the sin-eating scene back in Wales. He's been trapped in sin for a long time. He represents somebody who's trapped in sin and all the connotations that go with that in reference to an underclass that exists in modern America, trapped in the sins of the rich as well, which is also another interesting dimension, end quote. We see this notion of debt come... is an extremely prominent theme this season. Here are the debts that are relevant. Lorraine's character obviously is a debt collector. Munch plays a sin eater who had to like absorb people's sins. Indira, the cop, her husband is like taking on her debts. And it's like another way in which women are subjugated in our society is that they have to like take on the financial burden of the people that they marry very often. And then, of course, the case of Dot, who John Hamm's character, Tillman, is claiming as her own. You know, I mean,
he repeatedly says, like, she owes, yeah, well, he says quite literally, me, she yeah, owes him as a, there's a debt incurred by a wife who marries a husband. And so, like, yes, there's that idea as well.
Probably a little bit too on the nose there with that dialogue. But, you know, it's landing the point, which is like, this is a season about debts and who we expect them to, who we expect to pay the debts, who the debts are paid to, and how that manifests itself in different areas of our society. Mm-hmm. So
another one, too, that gets completely said, like explicitly stated, is Lorraine and the police. Like, there's a scene with Lorraine. Mm. Just to bring it up here, where she's talking to Indira about like, hey, you work for like your job as the police is to police the poor people. Like she expressly states that you don't have any power when you come into our space. And it's sort of this idea of like the debt that the police owe the powerful, or like the role they play in enforcing like her being a debt collector. So again, yeah, it's an interesting theme that runs just through all of this.
Yes, it is clearly what No Holly was focused on, I think. And I think largely those ideas work in the context of this season. It doesn't feel like, wow, he's really trying to cram it into all these places that doesn't make sense. With the possible exception of this Munch thing, which is just so off the deep end. I'm like, what is even happening here? You know? I mean, I think that there's an open question of, is that Munch? Mm-hmm. And he is like some ageless entity. Is that just some guy that looks like Munch, who's related to Munch? And the sins are passed down from generation to generation. Is it just a coincidence that that guy happens to look like Munch and he's completely unrelated to the rest of the plot? We don't know. I don't know that the show will make it clear. But what is clear is that Munch does a lot of creepy ass shit during the course of the season. He like breaks in and writes weird symbols on Tillman's children's bedroom and all this stuff like that.
I love the sequence that I mentioned earlier where he goes and moves into this woman's house that he has no relationship with, and he just says, I live here now.
Yeah, I mean, that was an amazing moment. That's
I
amazing
loved
moment.
That scene. That was fantastic.
I'm disappointed because they had been making Munch out to be such a cool, grounded badass. Like, everything that Munch did was squarely within the realm of reality. Mm-hmm. And that's still true. You know, like he hasn't done anything supernatural yet, but he's clearly influenced by the supernatural. And so I'm like, I kind of was a fan of Munch, like just being a Anton Chigurh-esque badass. And I don't know where that character is going to go now.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. But
for me, I particularly love that stuff. That again, I am the person who loves weird metaphorical out there stuff. That is my vibe, so I was here for it.
It's clearly like folk horror stuff that this show is dealing with. So anyway, there's one other character who we should really discuss. Jesse, tell us about Lorraine.
After Dot's successful defense of her home from Roy's men results in Wayne ending up in the hospital with brain damage, Lorraine attempts to institutionalize Dot, from which Dot escapes. Lorraine also attempts to stifle the police investigation into Dot out of worry it will cause her or her business trouble. Roy goes to visit Lorraine to seek her help in quote-unquote reclaiming Dot, but Roy's sexism proves distasteful to the ruthless and independent Lorraine, who stands up to the sheriff. Dot eventually retrieves her child, Scotty, and brings her to Indira, one of the officers investigating this case, to keep Scotty safe while she attempts to deal with Roy. And that's sort of where we leave off at the end of episode 5.
What do you think of the Lorraine character, Jesse? For me, the performance is not working for me. It feels way too over the top, kind of campy, very overly mannered. I'm not loving it. And I say that as a big fan of Jennifer Jason Leigh. I thought she was awesome in like Hateful Eight, for instance. I think she was also in, I want to say Possessor. Is that right? Anyway.
Yeah. Possessor is also wonderful. Yeah.
She's also in that movie. You know, like I'm a big fan of Jennifer Jason Leigh, and this performance is not working for me at all. But what do you think, Jesse?
It doesn't throw me out as much, but I will say she is very kind of one note. It's kind of like, yeah. Yes. It's like a very like kind of like 1920s businessman sort of put on to this character sort mm-hmm, of vibe mm-hmm. to her. And it doesn't really evolve that much. The part that I found most interesting was right at the end of episode 5, where she does have that scene with Roy, which is why I wanted to call it out, where she's had this sort of like antagonism and dislike of Dot throughout the entire like season so far. But then when she sees Roy and just him being a complete sexist asshole, it sort of pushes up against her, like probably the sexism that she's dealt with being a woman in that space, and her sort of like being like, oh, well, screw you, you're an asshole. And she kind of like, I doubt she'd be like, oh, I'm Dot's the best, but she sort of like pushes back against Roy and say, she doesn't owe you crap. And so
it's nice when the two biggest assholes in the show meet.
Exactly.
And they get to antagonize each other for once.
Exactly.
Nice.
Like that moment added a lot more depth to her character, whereas mm-hmm. throughout the season, she kind of just becomes a mouthpiece for like discussions of the 1% in America, mm-hmm. Which mm-hmm. doesn't really like evolve all that much. And I get why she's here. Like she plays an important role in the themes and ideas and dynamics that Noah Hawley clearly wants to play with. But yeah, I agree. And I think, again, you pointed this out in the spoiler free section, but it is definitely a disservice that it comes after House of Usher, which I also liked. I think I listened to your review on that, and I definitely came away more positive on that show than I think you did. But I also think that, like, yeah, this isn't really exploring anything. Her character isn't exploring anything new that show didn't already explore until this moment at the end with Roy and Lorraine, which is like where I really hope the rest of the season digs its teeth into, because that was an interesting moment for me.
Agreed. And to be clear, I didn't like
you hated it. You despised it.
No, I thought it was. I thought it was like
seen.
I would describe it as fun but flawed. That's mm-hmm. kind of how I describe it.
Yeah,
I had a good time with certain aspects of it, and but I think we can both agree that it is a pretty not subtle, over the top show.
Yes, you know, it like, it is very clear in what it's trying. I mean, it has a scene where we see a millionaire's standing on a pile of dead corpses, like billions of dead corpses. So I think it's very clear in what it's trying to say in that show.
Right.
Yeah,
but yeah, I thought when Lorraine confronts the Tillman character, that's like one of the highlights of the season for me mm-hmm. so far. And when she says, you know, oh, you want all the responsibility, or you want all the power but none of the responsibility, you know. You know what? They have a name for that. It's called a baby. And just like,
yeah.
Roy like has no response to that. Like he's mm-hmm. just kind of flummoxed by that. And I really love that. You know, that's a really wonderful moment.
And this guy who is very much like women are beneath men. They're there to serve men, being owned by this very powerful woman. It was, but again, you have complicated dynamics against Lorraine, because Lorraine is also terrible. So yeah, it was just very well done.
There is this weird episode called the episode 5 called The Tiger, which is mm-hmm. narrated like a documentary. I don't know, kind of weird. I didn't.
Yeah,
it would have been one thing if they like tried to imitate the aesthetics of a documentary more, you know, but it just felt like a weird thing
decision
to have happen. But this is this is a show that does weird things sometimes, like aliens show up and so on. So, you know, so it's like it's not completely out of character, but I don't know. What do you think?
It's an unresolved idea, because I like the concept. It kind of even similar to Munch, like with Munch's character, by showcasing that like this happened, you know, 500 years in the past, whether or not that character turns out to actually be Munch or not. It sort of ties in this idea that these like class distinctions existed throughout time is not a uniquely American problem, just appears in a way that is unique to America. And this sort of like idea of playing with this like documentary tiger idea, also sort of like playing with like women being more powerful than we think about them being, and in nature sort of like we've created these ideas that women are weaker than men in our society, but nature doesn't necessarily show that. Like it was an idea that I think kind of came out of that same sort of concept of like, look, this ties into other things in the world that we're equating to America. But yeah, it just is a half-formed thought. It doesn't really evolve all that much. So
Unfortunately, yeah, I don't think so. But you know, everything else that Juno Temple's character does in that episode is super cool.
Oh, it's,
you know,
wonderful!
The,
yeah,
the way that she escapes from the institution reminded me, honestly, this is kind of a random reference, of Britney Spears' conservatorship. This idea that essentially rich people have the resources to have basically anyone declared mentally incompetent, and therefore to be able to neutralize them or otherwise appropriate their resources, I thought was interesting and a very horrifying notion, right? That you could be trapped in that situation with very little way to escape. But obviously, they and everyone else in the show underestimate Dot's abilities to get out of a situation. Yeah,
and actually, jumping on that too, there is one moment that I really did like that kind of came off the documentary bit, but it actually felt more Sherlock Holmesian. There's that moment where they are about to bring her in to the to the institution, and she has this moment of like trying to think through all the ways she can try to escape the room. And yet none of them actually are, like, all the ways she thinks of to try to get out of the room are not going to work. And there's literally, in that specific situation, there's nothing she could have done to avoid being taken to the institution. And so it's sort of this idea, again, if we're going to talk about, like, gender dynamics that the show is very clearly trying to evoke, it's talking about, like, even the smartest woman, the woman who has escaped literal murderers and people trying to kidnap her, and can think in like 4D chess and think about all the moves that she could make, still can't escape sometimes when, you know, the institutions or the rich come to take them away and put them away. So yeah, it's an interesting sort of discussion about, like, you know, how these institutions sort of box in women specifically.
Any thoughts on the Indira character? You know, I've already alluded to how this idea of debt, obviously this character is very much in debt, and her husband is making it even worse for her. My wife was very moved by that final scene with Indira and Dot, because this idea of, even though Indira is a cop and theoretically a very morally upright one, she still understands, hey, I have to like bend the rules a little bit for Dot out of this idea of female solidarity. Like, they're both women who have been wronged somehow by the men that they are with. And Indira is going to help Dot out by, you know, watching her child for a little bit in a highly illegal, you know, like, if she'd get in big trouble for this if it was ever discovered, right? So yeah, any thoughts on that character?
It is interesting. I'm curious to see if the show, they haven't done a lot with it yet, but I'm curious to see what the show is going to do with discussing her role as a police officer. I mean, we've had Lorraine literally tell her, it's like, you work for us, your job as a police officer is to enforce the whims of the rich, essentially, which in America is arguably very, very true. And a lot of our discussions about police, particularly towards people of color and black men specifically in the past few years is, and especially since this set takes place in 2019, just a few years before things like George Floyd and stuff like that. But obviously something that's still going on throughout all of America's history. It's just, it sort of evokes a lot of these ideas with that. And I'm curious to see what the show's going to ultimately go with that. Because you also have Roy, who is a sheriff, who also is sort of like wielding his power in ways that is, you know, just benefiting him. So I'm just, it hasn't really evolved any of that yet, but I am curious that the show seems to be aware of that. I'm just sort of curious if it's going to do anything with it. Also, something else too, you reminded me of with the debt aspect of it, is there is also the police officer that Dot saved in the very first episode, who feels that he owes like a debt and thanks to Dot. So there's also that sort of element floating in there too, thematically. And that is also framed as like a debt that feels earnest rather than a debt that feels like based in some form of class dynamics.
I did think the whole situation with Dot trying to conceal her identity was kind of comical. Or people trying to conceal Dot's identity, like Gator deleting the photo from the phone. And it's like, oh my, I can't believe I didn't bring a spare of, it's like, we live in an iPhone age, you know, you're going to be able to easily get another copy of that photo. You know, you're, at most, you're delaying her by about 2 hours.
Well, I actually kind of bought it for both of their characters. It is a bit comical, but number one, I think that fits the like weird, like black comedy vibes of Fargo generally. But also, like, it fits Dot's character where she is almost, like, kind of unwilling to face the reality of the situation because she wants to preserve what she has
right,
so much.
Right.
And then also with what's his name? Gator's character deleting the phone. That just felt like an incompetent idiot move that fits his character very well. So like, I think for both of those moments, like, they are comical, but I think it fits the vibe of the show and the characters.
Fair enough. In terms of where I think the show's going, I think Dot's eventually going to be able to have a love. Let's save that for a minute before we get to my predictions for what's going to happen with the rest of the show. Jesse, why don't we let people know where they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Yeah, you can find me on my YouTube channel, Jesse Gender, where I do video essay style of stuff. I just recently released a really long video about the politics of Star Wars, where we did a whole animation segment that in sort of the Tartakovsky's Star Wars Clone Wars animation style, but talking about just the history of Star Wars and the monomyth and Joseph Campbell and all that jazz. So I'm really proud of that video. Please go check that out if you can. But I'm also on Jesse Gender After Dark, where I do reviews on that YouTube channel of different TV shows and movies and video games, things like that. And then I'm also on Nebula, which is a streaming service where a bunch of YouTubers put our video essays to escape the algorithm. They put exclusive content on there, and they have really cool things like a mutual friend of ours, Patrick Willems, just recently released a Star Wars holiday special on there, which is a lot of fun. I have a science fiction movie starring John DeLancey coming out on there early next year, which I'm pumped for. So yeah, sign up for Nebula to get all that fun stuff. So that's, and then I'm on all the social medias, Twitter, Instagram, all that jazz.
Well, you can email us at decodingtv@gmail.com and become a paid member at decodingtv.com to support this podcast and help to keep it going. We'd love to hear what you think of Fargo and any thoughts you've had about our conversation today. All right, Jesse, I wanted to make a few predictions for how this is all going to wrap up. I, just to be clear, I am terrible at this. And so,
I am also very terrible at this.
And too. so do not count any of this as fact or that I even feel super strongly about it. But I think that probably between John Hamm's character and his son, one of them's going to die,
mm-hmm.
and the other one will be arrested by the end mm-hmm. of the show. I'm not sure which one is which, but there's going to be some... basically, John Hamm's character has gone too far, and justice must be done, and therefore that justice will be in the form of him, one of them being arrested, the other one getting killed. I don't think it would be satisfying if neither of them died. I don't think it'd be satisfied if both of them died or only one of them got, you know, taken in, you know, so like, or I think you know what I'm saying. Like,
I know what I was saying.
One of them's going to die. One of them's going to get arrested. That's kind of my, that's the function of having two characters. One of the functions of having two characters is they can meet different fates. And so therefore I think that's what's going to happen there. Lorraine is going to be just fine. Although there's the possibility that the show is going to end with her being arrested and then needing to go to trial, but like, and we're not going to see the results of that, but she's going to be just fine because she's going to hire like the best defense.
Yeah,
team
I don't see
ever.
Her facing any repercussions. Like maybe yeah. there'll be an attempt to hold her accountable, but
yeah, either she's arrested or she's not arrested. She keeps doing what she's doing. Mm-hmm. And either way she like continues on just fine. And I think Dot and her husband will be reunited and make a life for themselves, even though her husband is dealing with probably some kind of permanent damage as a result of his electrocution. Mm-hmm. But that like they will eventually find some kind of peace and be able to make a life together in spite of everything that's happened. So those are my predictions for how the rest of the season is going to unfold. Jesse, what do you think? Any differences to what I'm guessing there?
No, I think you're generally pretty right about all of that. I will just I will go hyper specific just for the fun
wow.
of it. I don't know
Let's
if this is where it's going to be, but
Let's
we'll see. I think Dot and Roy will confront each other, and I think Dot will be the one to kill Roy. I think also Munch and Dot will have a scene together where it'll probably be late in the series, and it will be Munch sort of having a like respect, like he'll have a chance to mm-hmm. kill Dot, but then we'll be mm-hmm. like, no
yeah.
I see something in you, so I'm gonna let you live. Mm-hmm. And then she goes on to kill Roy. It'll be like right
you
it's
are
in the finale
fellow, You are a fellow sin eater, perhaps. Right?
Exactly. Ways, right? Yeah, like
you have absorbed some other debts. Basically,
we are not so different, you and I.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of I think those are like my two very specific predictions.
I think there's a world where Roy getting killed is due to Munch and therefore completely doesn't involve Dot at all. I think
that is possible.
That is a possible way that could go. Yeah.
The other way it could go if we kind of go with that reading is like the Dot and Munch meet up and Dot walks away letting Munch kill. Like she has a chance to.
Absolutely.
And she's like, I'm not going to do it. Munch, you do it, essentially.
Yes.
Sort of thing.
100%. Very possible. All right. Well, this is fun now, Jesse. We get to come back in 5
see
weeks
if we,
to see
we got it.
How horribly wrong both of us were about any of this.
Last season's all takes place on a spaceship. It's not too far outside the realm of possibility with this series.
It's not outside the realm of possibility that we flash backwards 500 years and literally the rest of the season just plays out there. Like that's
yeah.
I wouldn't put it past the show. Well, anyway, this has been enormously fun. Jesse Earle, thank you so much for chatting. Really appreciate you hanging out with me today.
Yeah, no, I'm always glad to do it. Thank you for having me back.
All right, and thanks for listening to Decoding TV. More episodes covering The Curse. Jesse and I are planning to do a Murder at the End of the World conversation sometime the next week or two. And also, probably there's going to be a podcast episode about the Crown at some point in the near future. So lots to discuss right here on Decoding TV. Stick around. We'll see you later. Goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.